This podcast is certified fresh.
Freshmediaworks.com.
Mikey Pod, episode 78, from Brooklyn.
Ethics is the aesthetics. Ethics is the aesthetics of Ethics is the aesthetics of the few.
The aesthetics of the few.
Aesthetics of the Ethics is the aesthetics of the few. Of the few. Of the few.
Sure.
Last summer, I spent a couple of weeks in a Buddhist monastery. No one was allowed to talk, or to read, or to write. It was very quiet there. The first night, I heard an unearthly voice coming from somewhere on the other end of the monastery. Sometimes the voice was a piercing shriek. Other times, a soft crooning. It went on for hours, the same word over and over again. It sounded like, Juanita! 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 I couldn't imagine who Juanita might be, or why someone needed her so badly, or why she never answered such an obviously desperate call. Later, I learned that the word wasn't Juanita at all, but Anatta, the word for ego, the word for self. And this is a song for Juanita.
Now, one.
Now,
pair.
One.
Sun.
Now,
pair.
One.
Sun.
Now,
one. Now, one. Now, one.
No father.
Now,
no son.
One.
Pair. Son.
No. Juanita.
Ask me now.
What do you know?
Juanita.
How do you
ask
know?
Me now.
Juanita.
What do
ask
you know?
Me now. Juanita, ask me now.
What do you know?
Juanita.
Juanita. Anna.
Rasta.
Nada.
Rasta.
Anna.
Rasta.
Anna.
Rasta.
Atta.
Rasta. You
know.
What do you know?
One. No. One.
Pair.
Now
one.
Son.
Now one.
Person.
Now one.
No father.
Now one.
No son.
Now.
Juanita.
Are you still here? That was Laurie Anderson from an album called Airwaves. I don't really know the history of it, but I'm pretty sure it's out of print, which is why I feel like it's probably okay to play it. I found it on UbuWeb, UBUWEB.com, maybe .org. And that is for my friend Gretchen, who is a badass for reasons that I'll not go into just because. But thank you, Gretchen, for listening and for supporting and all that kind of stuff. And everybody else who does the same. I went to buy a microphone stand here in New York City, which is where I'm based now. And I'm so excited. I'll be even more excited when I have a job, but that's a whole nother story. Anyway, I didn't buy a clip to go on the top of this microphone stand. So that means I'm holding it in my hand, which is a little annoying. So I don't think I'm going to talk very much today. I still have a kidney stone. I went to the hospital, and long story. Turns out the doctor couldn't see it. I mean, he was willing to totally discount it, and the hospital was too, only discounting it from $11,000 to $7,000. And then they wanted all this money, which Gretchen offered to help me with, which is why I'm so grateful. And all of that experience sort of taught me that things are just going to be taken care of. Although I still have a kidney stone, they couldn't blast it because it didn't show up on the x-ray, but it's not causing me any pain or any bloody pee. So I guess that's good. So I'm just going to go right into the second half of this interview with Millard Fuller. I still have this signed book to give away, and I had a contest in mind. Well, let's do it. Yeah. Well, you know what? Just how about the third person to email me? Can you tell I'm making this up as I go? After, how about this? After the interview, the second half of this interview, I will tell you what the contest is to win the autographed copy of Millard Fuller's Tools for Living, I think is the name of the book. I'm still getting unpacked, so I'm a little scattered. Let's go right to the interview, shall we? Bye-bye.
And on October 29, 1969, Clarence Sheridan died. Boom. Suddenly, he was down in his shack writing a sermon to be delivered at Mercer University. And God called him home. He just leaned his head back against the wall at age 57 and was gone, just like that. And, you know, and I got a real sense of how the disciples must have felt when they crucified Jesus. You know, they'd only been together 3 years.
Yeah.
And it looked like things were just getting cranked up, man. They had a big, exciting movement underway, and boom, he gets killed. And, I mean, it just was shocking.
Yeah.
And it was shocking for me to go down to the study and, you know, look, there's my friend. He's dead.
Right.
You know, we had all these big plans. We were gonna have all these farming programs and all this. You know, and we had so much planning. The guy's dead. You know, that wasn't in the plan.
Right.
57 years old. I mean, how could he be dead? He's dead. God's ways are not our ways. Mm-hmm. And but we had launched the housing program, and it just continued. You know, we buried him. I conducted his funeral and his burial. It wasn't a fancy funeral.
Well, at that time, he was still not well respected by the community, like in America and that sort of thing. Is that right?
Absolutely not. The man was brilliant. The man was courageous. You know, to use a well-worn phrase, a lot of people say he was ahead of his time.
Yeah.
But he wasn't ahead of God's time. He may have been ahead of some people's time, but he was right on time as far as God is concerned.
Right.
And espousing the universal value of people, espousing peace and non-materialistic way of life, all of those are universal values, timeless values. But yeah, when he died, I was, some people mistakenly felt like that I became director when he died. I was already the director. He wasn't the director. He was the person that started the place with his wife, Florence, but he wasn't a director and didn't want to be the director. He was the spiritual father of this place, and the theologian and the Bible scholar and the speaker and the teacher. But when he passed away suddenly, we knew we had to, you know, we couldn't just put him in the ground. You had to get a death certificate, and then the authorities here wouldn't come out here. I called a medical examiner, I called a coroner, none of them would come. And so they said I should get an ambulance and take him into town. Well, Clarence and I had spent a lot of time talking about that kind of thing, and he did not believe in spending money on a dead body. We had talked about that, so I knew what his thinking was. So I said, no, Clarence Sheridan wouldn't agree to hire an ambulance to haul around a dead body. So I put him in the back of a station wagon and took him into America's and went to the emergency room, and they did an autopsy and gave me his body back at midnight, naked, wrapped in a sheet. And we brought him out here, and I bought at that time there was a coffin manufacturer here in town, and I bought a box that they ship coffins in, paid, I think, $5 for it. And we put him in that, put his overalls on him, and we put him in that $5 pine box and hauled him back over here on the backside of the farm and dug a hole in the ground and put him in there. And, of course, as you know, there's no marking for his grave.
Yeah.
He didn't believe in, you know, his idea was, and I agree with it, you know, before you're born, you didn't take up space on the earth. Why should you take up space after you're dead?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And, you know, I know that you're planning to go to New York when you leave here.
Yeah.
If you go into either the John Kennedy Airport or the LaGuardia Airport, when you're driving into the city, you'll see hundreds of acres are taken up with graveyards.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And what a waste. Hundreds and hundreds of acres of dead bodies are out there taking up all that space.
It's so funny when you put it like that. It's just like, yeah, it's dead bodies. But it's true. I mean, I feel the same way.
Right. You know, when you die, you know, your spirit remains. I mean, I don't need a tombstone to remind me about Clarence Jordan. It's his life and his witness and who he was that I remember.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people like a gravestone to go to. I mean, I don't want to make fun of them in any way,
right.
But it just was so contrary to his philosophy. And I've embraced it as my own. I've given instructions when I die, you know, do just like it did with Clarence Jordan. Go out here on the backside of the farm and dig a hole and put me in it.
Yeah.
And cover it over and don't take up any space on earth for my dead body.
Yeah.
And let it go back to the earth and grow grass and grow trees and have a place, maybe some kids can play on it or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot more natural thing to do. I mean,
yeah.
It's funny that I'm thinking about composting this time, which is something I didn't really do before I came here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that same sense of like, well, it's entirely different, I guess. We're speaking of humans and like mm-hmm. apple mm-hmm. core or something. Mm-hmm. But then is it really that much different, I guess?
Right.
That's my thought.
Well, when life leaves the body, you have no further use for it.
Yeah,
you know who you are as a person isn't, you know, you is. I mean, that's your physical body, your foot here, your hands, and so forth. But that's not really you, because you'd still be you if you cut off your hand.
Yeah,
you'd still be you if you cut off your arm. And when the body dies, the essence of who you are is your spirit that lives on. I believe.
Yeah,
and is not you know your body's. You know, you had that for a period of time, but it's now, that's over.
Yeah.
Anyway, we brought him back out here, laid him out, and the people in the community came and extended their condolences to Florence and others in the community, and we put him on the back of a pickup truck and drove him over there. And I had a daughter that was born out of the reconciliation between my wife and me, and we named her Faith.
Hmm.
She lives here in town now, but
she
was 2 years old at that time. And she stepped up to the edge of the grave as we were lowering his body into the ground and sang happy birthday to him.
Hmm.
It's the only little song she knew, you know. And so Clarence was a person that loved children, and children responded to him very well. And so she knew her friend was in that box, and she knew that he was something big was happening at just a little 2-year-old child.
Right.
You know? But in her child's mind, she wanted to pay tribute to him. And she did it by singing this little song that she knew. Happy birthday, Clarence.
Yeah.
Happy birthday to you.
I'd forgotten about that. I think in the very beginning of the internship, it was like, here, learn more about Clarence. So I think that was in that sort of waterfall of information.
Yeah.
But that's a beautiful story.
Yeah. And she's the one that did the documentary.
Oh, yeah.
I was in the cotton patch.
Which is great. I just watched it again, actually,
nights ago. Yeah, it's an Iowa documentary that won an Emmy Award. She was shown nationally on public television. And when she became an adult, she, you know, being a little kid when she was here, it was just she saw Cornelia through the eyes of a little kid.
Yeah.
But after she got grown, she realized the powerful impact that this place and this man had on her family. And on her, and she wanted to document it. And so she spent over 3 years putting that documentary together.
Yeah. It still runs on PBS.
Oh, yeah. And it has really, her documentary has touched and moved many, many people.
Yeah. I'm working in product, so I'm entering all the orders in, and there are lots of times I'll see a note that says, saw a documentary on PBS. So a lot of people got reached, I think, who would not have known about
Narnia. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to talk a little about how the housing started, because it's still a little foggy to me. What I mean, I know you came back here, and you and Clarence were working together, and at first you didn't really know what the ministry was going to be, right?
And, well, you know, that's you asked me before we started this interview, was there something that was not well known or hadn't been well discussed about Koinonia? And what I'm about to tell you is one of those things. A commonly asked question to me is how did Habitat for Humanity really get started? You know, what was the genesis of it? What caused you to do that instead of something else?
Right.
And, you know, you go back and back and back. And obviously, when I came here and met Clarence Jordan, that was a part of the equation, which eventually resulted in what was called partnership housing. And then when Linda and I moved to Africa, we started what was called the Housing Project. And then we came back to Koinonia in 1976, and sitting in an old chicken barn over there, we brainstormed into existence Habitat for Humanity. And I'm a lawyer. I incorporated Habitat for Humanity, and it got started in 1976. So here we are at the end of 2006. Mm. And so this is 30 years down the pike, and more than 200,000 houses have been built, and more than a million people now have a house. But if you want to go back beyond me and Clarence Jordan, what really was the sort of the impetus for this whole idea was the poor people of Sumter County. Because what happened was Clarence Jordan was here with his wife Florence, and there was only one other couple, Will and Margaret Whitcamper. Mm-hmm. And Koinonia had fallen on hard times. Everybody was gone except those two older couples. And Will and Margaret Whitcamper was considerably older than Clarence and Florence. And Clarence and Florence had pretty much given up on Koinonia. And they had said, you know, we just want to sell this place and leave. But Will and Margaret Whitcamper did not want to leave. Mm. They wanted to stay here. But Clarence and Florence said, how are we going to stay here? The farming is gone. They got the boycotts, killed all the farming. We got no way to sell products. And the only way we're living is living on donations that people send in here. And that's not a good use of our time. And maybe I ought to go teach at a seminary or do something else. And Margaret and Will Whitcamper and Florence and Florence Jordan, four of the most dedicated Christians I ever knew in my life, got so crossed up with each other that they couldn't talk without a recording machine being on. They would have a recording machine on like we have here right now to make sure that what was said was not misinterpreted or misquoted by somebody later on.
Oh, wow.
It was just unreal how the relationship between those four had become so tense. And so then talk got out in the community here around in rural Sumter County that Koinonia is going to close. That was the word that got out. So a lot of these poor people, especially these African-American families who own no property, they were living on somebody else's land, they came by and they would go to Clarence Jordan and say, Mr. Clarence, before y'all leave, would you sell me a little piece of land? Because I'd like one day to have a house.
Mm-hmm.
And would you sell us a little piece of land? And Clarence Jordan drew off several lots up there on the north edge of the farm where Koinonia Village is today.
Okay, yeah.
And he had actually sold about four of those lots. And I showed up.
Okay.
And so really and truly, the idea that was at the tap root of Habitat for Humanity was the poor people of Sumter County coming to Koinonia and saying, please let us have a little piece of land so we can one day have a house.
Yeah.
There was no money to build any houses, but if they got a little piece of land, they thought maybe one day I might have a chance to get my own place. And that is what Clarence Jordan told me when I came here, that there was this big need, felt need, that these low-income African-American families around here had this great desire for a house. And so that is really why we started the Partnership Housing Program, was to meet that need of all these people who said they want a house. And we built the first houses on the lots that had already been sold to about four families. The Johnson family was one of the families. They got the first house. And then we started building houses on lots with a long-term lease on them, 60-year lease, I think it was, yeah. Renewable lease. And they would pay like a couple of dollars a year for ground rent, and then they'd just pay for the house. And this was inconsistent with Clarence's philosophy about land ownership. He felt it was wrong to buy and sell the earth because the earth belonged to God. How can you sell the earth? You know, you can sell a tree, or you could sell a board, or you could sell some minerals, but with sell the earth itself, that belongs to God. You shouldn't do that. So that was his idea of just having people have tenure rights but not actually own the property. Years later, families came to us and said, we're not happy because we don't have a fee simple title to our lots. And we said, and so we had a meeting. This was after Clarence Jordan died. And so we said, well, we'll sell it to you. If you want a deed to the property, we'll sell it to you. So we'll sell the lots to you for $200, which is practically a gift.
Yeah.
Well, but these are poor people, see? So they said, okay, we can continue to pay $2 a year or $200. Every last one of them opted to keep paying $2 a year for the land. Because then once they knew they could buy it,
yeah,
they were happy.
That's all they needed was just
they just wanted to know they could buy it if they wanted to. And so these people up here at Corny Village, as far as I know, are still just paying a little annual rent.
Like the little $2 thing still?
$2 or $3, something like that. But anyway, as the whole program evolved and as we started building houses in Americas under the banner of Habitat for Humanity, the lots were sold to the people. We didn't do any more of that leasing of the land. Okay. We'd sell the land to the people.
Right.
Along with the house.
And all that works with, I think I understand how this works, but just to make sure, they're like low interest
no
loans?
No interest.
No interest loans?
No, the houses are built. And this is, again, straight from Clarence's understanding of the scripture. Exodus 22:25 says, if you lend money to any of my people who are poor, do not charge interest. And so we charge no interest, add no profit. Clarence would say, what the poor need is not charity, but capital. They don't need caseworkers, they need co-workers. And so we would provide capital for them, build the house, move in, they'd help build it, and then start paying the money back over a 20-year period at no profit and no interest. Because a traditional method of buying a house, as you know, is you go to the bank, you get a mortgage, the bank provides the money to the builder, you move in, start making monthly payments, and you pay 6%, 7%, 8%, whatever you pay, and over the lifetime of the mortgage, you get one house but pay for two or three, depending on the interest rate.
Yeah.
And a poor person can't afford to pay for three houses. They can afford to pay for one, but not three.
Yeah, yeah.
So you take away interest and take away profit, and a poor person will get one house and pay for one house, and they can afford it then.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds so simple, but still, I mean, people don't get it or are unable to do that.
Many people do get it and they embrace it. That concept has been embraced by so many people. And now we've, since 2005, started the Fuller Center, which is using much of the same methodology of Habitat for Humanity, but we've added some new wrinkles. The biggest one of which is called the Greater Blessing Box.
Mm-hmm.
Koinonia here now has a program called Heart to Heart Home Repair.
Right.
And they go out here and largely renovate and repair homes of the elderly, who are people on fixed income. Maybe the roof has a leak, or some windows are broken, or the front porch is falling in, or some other problem needs painting.
Yeah.
And all this work is done by volunteers, and the Fuller Center then gives $10,000 a month to Koinonia to be used to buy materials. And instead of putting a mortgage on the house, you give them a greater blessing box, you know, because the Bible says it's more blessed to give than to receive. It is blessed to receive. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes to you and your house leaks, a roof needs fixing or whatever, the bathroom's got a problem, and a bunch of volunteers show up and fix it for you without any charge. You say, wow,
yeah,
I'm blessed. You know, I couldn't do that. I'm poor. I couldn't go out and hire a contractor, so I'm blessed. But the Bible says it is more blessed to give than to receive. So you've been blessed by receiving. But if you want to get the greater blessing, then you give. And we give them opportunity to receive the greater blessing. So we made these greater blessing boxes, which are made right here at Koinonia.
Oh, okay.
And then you talk to this elderly person whose house has been fixed up, and you say, look, we spent $1,000 fixing up your house. We want to give you an opportunity to receive the greater blessing now. You've received one blessing by getting your house fixed up. But if we gave you the opportunity to pay the money back, over what period of time do you think you could do it? So you sit down at the kitchen table with them and say, look, I have to pay so much for medicine every month, and I got so much for food, and I got so much for clothing. I really believe if you gave me 3 years, I could pay that $1,000 back. So you put 36 envelopes in the greater blessing box. You give them a Bible, you give them a greater blessing box, and you say, look, this is not a legal obligation. If you don't pay this, no collection agency is going to come see you. No lawyer is going to write you a nasty letter. You've just decided you don't want the greater blessing. But if you pay the money back, we'll use it to help somebody else. And you will, on the basis of the Bible, receive the greater blessing.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing that here now for the past year at Koinonia, and the people are paying. They're sending their envelopes in.
Wow.
And that's a new and exciting new wrinkle, as I say, or a new twist on the traditional methodology that Habitat for Humanity uses.
Yeah. And I think there are lots of people who would say, oh, that wouldn't work. They'd never pay it back. You know, but, well, guess what? They're paying it back.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, not 100%, but nothing in this world works 100%.
Yeah.
And it's much better than many programs, especially when they go into disaster hit areas, like following Katrina. Organizations like Rebuilding Together or Samaritan's Purse or Youth with a Mission or many church groups, they just go down there and give everything away.
Yeah.
They don't even ask the people to help. And I was in San Diego, California recently, and Youth with a Mission people have been going down to Mexico, and over the past few years they'd built 2,000 houses. I said, what about repayments? They said, oh, no, we just give them to the people. I said, what if you'd given them all a greater blessing box and given them the opportunity to receive the greater blessing? What if only 10% of them had paid the money back? You'd be able to build 200 more houses.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
So it's just something that ought to be done, not only by the Fuller Center for Housing, but by many other organizations, and that's what we're advocating now, is for organizations to use that concept. Because if you do, you help maintain the dignity of the people who've been helped. You know how you would feel if somebody came to you and said, Michael, I can see that you're a helpless person. You are incapable of doing anything for yourself, and you poor slob, I'm going to help you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to help you out. I'm going to just shower things on you. But I don't want you to do anything except when I get through helping you, I want you to pose because I want to take a picture and go post it in my church so people will know what a wonderful person I am.
Yeah.
Because I want people to see that I help poor people like you who are helpless. And
and
I have to come and help them because you are just totally worthless yourself. But I'm a really sharp, nice, caring, loving, gentle, wonderful Christian. And so I'm helping you,
right?
But you don't need to do anything because you're obviously stupid and helpless. How does that make you feel?
Yeah, not so good.
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of glad to get the help, but you, as a human being, you've been diminished.
Yeah.
But what if they came to you instead and said, Michael, I see you're in need here. Your house is falling down. I'm going to help you put it up, but I want to give you a chance to pay the money back. And if you do, I will help you. We'll take your money and help somebody else. Wow.
Yeah. You get to feel part of the cycle.
Yeah, yeah. I'm getting help, but now I'm going to be able to help somebody else. Makes you feel better about yourself.
Yeah.
So that's what we do. This new organization we've started is just taking off like a rocket. And people have been so wonderful in their support of it. Just as they came forward and helped get Habitat for Humanity started.
Yeah.
But this place, Koinonia, has been the place that's given birth not only to Habitat for Humanity, to the Fuller Center for Housing, but to Jubilee Partners and to thousands of people like yourself, Michael, who have come here searching. Mm-hmm. It's been a place to come apart and get it like in this, you know, very simple place where you're living here, but adequate,
yeah,
modest, and you can get in touch with yourself. You can walk around in these woods and think about things and figure things out. I know what it meant for me and for my family, and I've seen it have a transformative effect on many others who've come here.
Yeah. Quite a place. That puts it briefly. It's quite a place, but yeah, and it's hard to explain. I've been trying to do that, but you've done a much better job than my attempts have been. Yeah, I just heard the lunch bell ring, so that means
so we got to go lunch
for a while. Yeah, and I think it's time to go eat.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming by and being on the show. I appreciate you.
Michael, thank you, and God bless you in your continuing quest.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. I see the writing on a different wall. These toothless wishes, these sweet impressions, and every jump is closer to a fall. Is this September or just October? Am I falling here forever? Tomorrow now or something keeps me distant. I stay awake and keep this in it. Never, ever, never disappointed, and never looking out into the distance, never talking or keeping quiet. So I'm here, solidly in between. So I'm here, keep me from
Could you tell that was me? That was a song called Here. I recorded it probably like 3 or 4 years ago on my Yamaha Motif, which I don't have any longer. It's a long story. Signs of Financial Instability. I pawned it. That was the greatest keyboard ever, and I miss it dearly. But I decided something I need to do on this is, something that happened while I was at Koinonia was I realized, oh yeah, I'm a composer. And so I need to honor that. That's kind of a New Year's resolution for me. So I'm going to, I got a keyboard. I got another, it's like a MIDI controller keyboard that Bren found donations for, so we can continue writing our musical, which I didn't even mention on the show the whole time I was at Quantinia that that was going on. I don't know why I do that, but I need to get over it. So I think this week I'm going to try to record one of the songs from the last musical I wrote with Bren, called Rain on the Roof. And I'll just do a little demo of it so you guys can hear some of that. And maybe I'll talk about the other things that I've got going on as well. Anyway, that's all for today. I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to have another podcast for you on Monday. Also on Monday, I'm restarting The Velvet Voice, which is over at Podcaster News. And I will I'll give you all the details about that on Monday's show. So I'm going to be a little more consistent now that I'm kind of getting rooted in a city. And I'm so happy to be in Brooklyn, and I'll tell you more about it next week. Thanks for listening. Let me know what you thought about that last song. Oh, the contest. If you can name, this is so easy. Just go to the koinoniapartners.org website and find out the name of the documentary that was done by Millard Fuller's daughter, Faith. And tell me the name of that, and I'll send you this book. The autographed copy of Millard's book, which is packed, and I can't remember the exact name of it. So anyway, 206-339-6682. That'd be the great way to enter with a voicemail. But you could also email me at mikeypod@gmail.com or make a comment on the website, mikeypod.com. Thanks for listening, and Happy New Year.